My name is Michael McCusker. When I woke up this rather dark December morning, I saw the moon one night past full, perched atop a tall spruce tree outside a window of my house. It seems like, rather than a star, it was the moon that crowned the Christmas tree, and it just stayed there like a bird in a nest for at least a few moments before it started to slip down the branches. Well, last Thursday, December 12th, it has been 3 years since Frances Cook died of ALS. She was my sister's partner, and we were helping her towards the end of her life. Actually, my sister helped her all the way through. I just got called in for muscle at the last month or so, like we did our mother and our aunt. But it slipped right past me without my remembrance last Thursday, so I would like to dedicate today's program to her with my apology for having forgotten. And Arthur Honeyman, who died 5 years ago, December 8th, 2008, which is also the anniversary of the Great Astoria Fire of December 1922. Well, this morning I'd like to read a couple of articles that I wrote, more or less to do with the season. The first one I wrote many, many years ago, so it reflects a rather turgid writing style I had at the time, or at least for the subject. And then the second one is a little more recent, but still not quite that recent. I'd like to say that this is my opinion, and perhaps my opinion only in all of the parallel universes. That's my disclaimer. The first one I call the Peace Cardinal. A dark, thin, intense figure cloaked in the color of blood, his long hands the pale white of the heavenly host, raised in blessing, the bulging eyes popped from faces of shock, walked down the long carpet of history toward a railed altar and the beginning of his church. In those long-ago, ghostly, dust-cracked days of repression, when the first hairy, unbathed Christians were the Sunday afternoon entertainment for the predecessors of today's sports crowd, the frightened followers of the martyr bravely took their gospels to the streets, acting out their satires and truths in a theater of reality aptly called, in a name that has survived the centuries and subsequent snowballing tyrannies, guerrilla theater. And His Eminence, Gregoria Cardinelli Chanti, known also as the Pope of Peace, aka Frenchy, linked himself to the historic chain and walked his lonely walk down the crimson carpet of Precious Blood Catholic Church, followed by the unseen phantoms of centuries desiccated wild-eyed men and women of mercy and peace. Startled faces came awake with the crispy passage, and a quiet murmur began to fill the church, the walls of which hid the sun except through mosaic glass windows. A speechless priest watched in dumbfounded amazement as he was blessed by the strange apparition, clad in robes of a cardinal, a huge crucifix green and scarred by time chained to his neck, who turned and in a fast, strong voice cracking with emotion and fear of his act, called the church a false church, and 1,000 of the faithful couldn't believe what was happening before their own eyes. Nothing, absolutely nothing, had prepared them for this vision, or if you will, for it truly was, this miracle, this triumph of the soul. It was the first Sunday of Advent, 2 millennia after the birth of the man God, who once accosted the Templars in their once hallowed halls in a time of grotesque perversion similar to this. And how many have done it since? It was almost time for communion. The tired priest was winding up his windy sermon to the bored faithful who were fidgeting in this most laconic time of the Mass, waiting for this thing to end so they could get back to the real Sunday ritual of football and beer or whiskey. In the vestibule, unseen, regaled in the ancient robes redder than a raspberry popsicle, stood His Eminence, Gregoria Cardinelli Chanti. It was the first Sunday of Advent, that time of prayer before the coming of the Prince of Peace. As Catholics, we have entered into the full week prior to the Christmas of Advent, the priest said from the pulpit. Funny how all those faces look alike, smug, gray almost, except for the women, painted in gaudy colors, renegades of nature where the general rule calls for the males to strut the plumage to whatever churches birds and lions attend. Quiet, average, sleepy, God-fearing believers, tight with their nickels when the baskets were passed. I ask you for your prayers for peace and alms for peace, asked the priest, who was actually a bishop. His next words choked in his throat. An agony of shock popped his eyes and dropped the gate of his jaw. The sleeping faithful stirred, awakened, and mirrored their priest. Gregoria Cardinelli Chanti had emerged from the vestibule. He walked toward the altar, blessing the throng. He stopped, genuflected before the huge crucifix suspended dead center over the altar, rose and passed his blessings in a graceful sweep of his pale white hand to the priest bishop. He then faced the startled congregation and in a voice ringing throughout the huge cavern shouted, "Hypocrisy! False doctrines! False truths! How can we pray for peace and give alms for peace when the peoples of the world are engaged in domestic wars and international wars? How can we also pray for peace and give alms for peace when the Pope himself refuses to intervene in wars and the causes of wars, poverty, ignorance, intolerance, and greed? We are to fight ourselves for the true preservation of peace and love, and not listen to false words. How can we fight for peace when the church itself is splitting into many factions over the controversy of that beautiful birth control pill and abortion?" That was when the cops came. They poured in through the front of Precious Blood Catholic Church, the rear and the windows, rushing the poor, lonely figure standing now silent with his hands clasped. Frenchie's real name is Roger Gigolo, and wits like to call him Gigolo. He was once to be a priest and spent 3 years in a seminary. He abandoned the cloth because he was abhorred by the hypocrisy. His name of Gregoria Cardinelli Chanti means simply Gregorian chant. He sings out for peace. Hustled out of the Church of Precious Blood in a bum's rush by the brethren of the beloved Keystone Cops, he was surrounded by angry faces in blue uniforms demanding his identification. Frenchie reached into his robes and brought out his baptismal certificate. "As a true confirmed believer of Christ," said His Eminence, "this is all the identification I need." "Are you queer?" righteously asked one of the upholders of all that is good and decent in America. "I am queer for Christ," the cardinal of the streets smiled beatifically. He was trundled into a patrol car to police headquarters where the gendarmes badgered him with questions. "Can I have a chair?" Frenchie asked after a while, and a sitting cop kicked one over to him. "Oh, blessed Lord," he prayed, "bless this chair for this weary body, and bless these policemen who have been so kind and have given me this blessed chair to rest this weary body." "Get him out of here," screamed a cop. Though they wouldn't admit it to Frenchie, the boys in blue were confused as to exactly what he was guilty of. A high-level conference with a public defender set them straight. He was guilty of nothing. The state cannot interfere with matters of the church. They let him go. Later in the afternoon, after having walked through the startled streets blessing the Sunday throngs, in his last ecclesiastical effort of the day, Frenchie began the weekly meeting of Veterans for Peace with a convocation, just like they do at city council meetings. "Blessed are the merciful, for they shall obtain mercy," he prayed, head bared of skullcap, long white hands clasped. It was one of the seven Beatitudes, the same prayer he offered the disgruntled police earlier when they drove him back to the empty Church of Precious Blood where they had found him. "And bless the peacemakers, for they shall inherit the earth." It was a time of war, so awful the ancient written horrors of hell were but children's fancy in comparison. It was a time of hatred so stark and intense, entire races were subject for slaughter. Wars were bought and paid for by greedy hands, placating their young tools, who were about to die and kill, with pious treacheries called patriotism. The land, skies, and seas were poisoned by the chemicals fueling the mighty war industries. Armies plundered and murdered or waited on their leashes for the war drums. Ugly gray navies ranged the seas like mad Baskervilles. Air forces circled the skies around the clock, armed with weapons capable of immolating the earth, awaiting only the signal to strike. Cities huddled in fear behind their nuclear walls of missiles jabbing heavenward. Corporate man thrived. Individual man, woman was dead. Sex was a pop ploy. Love was dead. In the midst of all this, clinging to hope like thirst-crazed lost tribes to dead rivers, wild, intelligent men and women fought like outraged tigers against the suicidal genocide of their time. Like the early Christians, they daunted repressive authority, were beaten and jailed, blessed their tormentors, and went at it again. And one among them shook the very walls of the corrupted temples themselves. He emerged on a normal day, a Sunday, quiet with the sun struggling its winter light, through the ozone, beginning his lonely pilgrimage through the heartland of ignorance and anger, offering his body, as did the true Christ, who was, after all, only a carpenter. And that was the Peace Cardinal, and I wrote it in 1968. Just a few months of after leaving the Chicago Democratic Convention. And, of course, apologies perhaps to the new Pope, not the one of 1968, who actually, Pope Paul, I believe it was, and he kind of nixed everything Pope John the 23rd did in the Second Ecumenical Council of the early 60s, which actually brought a whole new generation of priests and nuns who were much more, you might say, liberal. And they remain like the nuns on the bus, if you remember them, of a year or so ago. But we'll see what this new pope is about as time goes. The next I'd like to read, that I also wrote, so the disclaimer holds, The Road to Mandala. And it's sort of in the same vein. His teacher said he should die in North America. North America was a mandala. Everything was there. He had spent his life in Japan. He had been a nuclear engineer before he took the vows of a Buddhist monk. His life was devoted to peace and a belief that a new age was approaching, preceded by a time of disaster that would clean away the rot of the old. The United States was particularly important to the future, his teacher said. The shadows that would cross the earth before the brightness would darken the United States first. Prophecies were not guarantees, but paradoxes, his teacher warned. Only the hard work and sacrifice of men and women who cherished peace and harmony would light the darkness. Anything less than the earth would soon be as dead as its moon. He must be a candle, his teacher urged. There was no other purpose for a priest. His name was Suzuki Katsumi. He had been a monk 2 years, and a year before that he had helped build a pagoda dedicated to world peace in Ceylon, the island nation of Sri Lanka. He left Japan with 6 other monks. He arrived in North America on the anniversary of his youngest uncle's death, attempting to crash his warplane into an American warship. For 3 months, he walked across the continent with American Indians who sought redress for broken promises and forsaken treaties. He lived in Canada almost a year and spent a winter in a cabin on an island in Puget Sound. After a month of nonviolent protest against construction of a nuclear submarine base near Seattle, he hitchhiked down the Oregon coast toward California, where he was to join the Indians once more, this time in an effort to halt the building of nuclear power plants on treaty lands and to prevent the ravaging of the Black Hills for uranium. He wore his monk's robes wherever he went, even standing alongside a road. His vestments were startling. Over a gown white as bone was a robe more orange than a sunset. At his sandaled feet was a small Boy Scout haversack that was filled with rice wrapped in cellophane plastic, fresh tabi socks, a toothbrush, and a half-filled pouch of cigarette tobacco he had found on the roadway. He did not raise his thumb at passing cars, only his eyes, while he patiently beat on a small drum and chanted. He stayed 3 days at an old motel near Arch Cape as a guest of its owner. Several times a day he walked across a meadow that sloped above the beach and sat on a wood bench surrounded by spruce trees and salal bushes on three sides. The open side faced the ocean. There he beat his drum and chanted for hours. The chant was his single contribution, his weapon, and his prayer. Suzuki the monk hardly resembled his past incarnation, Suzuki the nuclear engineer. When he spoke of his former self, it was briefly and only to make a point. The point was generally that he had come so far around from what he had been, so could anyone else. The point was that he had been wrong, and now he felt he was doing what needed to be done. Briefly, the former Suzuki had been in love with money and technology. He was ambitious and intensely competitive. His vision of the future was dramatically opposite monk Suzuki's, and he chanted in a more obscure and specialized idiom. He helped design nuclear power plants and engineering systems. He is not sure when he first noticed his own core was suffering a meltdown. He thought he had lost his soul. He went to India, the ancient holy land where the Buddha was born, to find himself. He visited temples and followed the travels of Gautama. He went to the holy land of Ceylon to climb a holy mountain and there met a Japanese monk who told him that a pagoda to peace was being built on the mountain. He thought he would stay and help only a few days. He was on the mountain a year, and afterward he became a monk. Almost a year later, he received information from the United States that American Indians were walking across the country from San Francisco to Washington, D.C. His spiritual master had told him many times that the United States was a vital key to the future. Peoples and religions from every part of the world had immigrated to the United States. Such diversity, thrown so closely together, could erupt in explosion or cohabit as a model of harmony. That was where his work should be. Do not come back to Japan, the old monk told the younger monk. Die in North America. By the time Suzuki reached the United States, the Indians had already walked to Illinois. There he joined them, and for 3 months he stayed with them, sleeping in prairies and woods, walking 25 miles each day, chanting each mile. He went to Canada afterward. He helped organize a cultural exchange between Indians living in Canada and their counterparts in Japan, the Ainu, who had been dispossessed of their ancestral lands by the Japanese invaders more than 1,000 years ago. He lived in Vancouver, British Columbia, for 6 months, then wintered on Quadra Island in Puget Sound. He lived in a cabin and spent the days watching eagles as they hunted in the sky over the island. In the spring, he came down to Ground Zero. That was the name of a group that had formed to nonviolently protest, halt, or otherwise confound construction of a Trident nuclear submarine base outside Seattle. Each day he spent with the group, he walked to a fence surrounding the project and chanted. After a month, he started along the coast for California. Sitting on the bench overlooking the Pacific Ocean, he explained the importance of his chant. It was not the words so much as the repetition, he said. The repetition emptied the mind and opened the soul. Namu myoho renkyo, over and over and over again. Inner happiness was a result of chanting, he said, and happiness spread from one to many. To him, it was that simple. Happy people do not make war upon one another. They do not despise, cheat, lie, or do harm to each other. Chanting, he said, was the beginning of harmony and sharing. Suzuki is a monk of the sect known as Japan Buddha Sangha, which studies only ancient Sanskrit and has been involved in nonviolent protest against war for more than half a century. During World War II, most of its members were in jail or exile. After the war, they built 40 peace pagodas throughout Japan. Suzuki said that an international peace conference was planned by several groups in Japan. The conference was to be held in either Tokyo or Hiroshima. He favored Hiroshima. Americans remember Pearl Harbor. Japanese remember Hiroshima. Every year there is international conference against atomic war in Hiroshima, he said. Every August 6th, when bomb drop, in Japan, spiritual conference, not propaganda, not technique, very spiritual. We hope to make religious nonviolence against all kinds of war. Peace movement in Japan and the world split so many times like cells in body, but body is whole. We want to make peace whole again. California was more immediate. He was going to help the American Indian movement in a three-pronged demonstration that started with a marathon. The tribes had run from San Francisco to Los Angeles. Each day, runners from several tribes, including, Suzuki said, a tribe from Japan, ran 10-mile relays for a daily total of 100 miles. He would join them in Los Angeles, where the Indians and their supporters would split up into three caravans. The first caravan would go to Diablo Canyon for a large demonstration against a nuclear power station the utilities would like to build on Indian land. The second group planned a longer journey. It was going to the Black Hills in South Dakota. Businessmen want uranium like ancestor wants gold 100 years ago, Suzuki said. Governments say land belonged to Sioux, but underground belonged to government. The final caravan would go up the Calamus River near Crescent City. Last year, FBI killed two Indians for salmon fishing. This year become more excitement. He would join the third group. One monk go to Diablo Canyon, another monk go Black Hills. If I choose, I go Diablo as former nuclear engineer. But it make no difference. Any place I go, it is the same. Canada, Oregon, Washington, California, it make no difference. He said that he and the other monks who worked for peace followed the Lotus Flower Sutra. Written as a proclamation of the Buddha, this part was Suzuki's guide and his goal. Those who are not saved, I will save. Those who are not free, I will set free. Those who are not comforted, I will comfort. He told the story of another monk who was a spiritual example. Long time ago, one monk not very smart. He is poor in the head. He always do same action. He meet people, and he bow, and he say, I am reverence and respect to you. I never look down on you because someday you practice Buddha's Dharma and become Buddha. I am respect to you. Some people think he crazy monk. Some people throw rocks to him, and he run away. But he all the time turn around and bow, and he say, I am respect to you. More rocks come, and he run, stop, bow, and say, I am respect to you. All the time, everywhere he go, he always do same action. This dumb monk, he smarter than all the rest of the people. He is Buddha before reincarnation. We are following same action, chanting and beating drum. This how we meet businessman and soldier. We bow and make respect to them. Sometimes they throw rocks to us, but no matter. Somebody already punched at me. I was very glad. He even seemed pleased that some Americans called him a Jap. Japa in Sanskrit means chant, he said. Japamara is holy necklace for chanting. So they call me Jap, is what I am and what I do. I am laughing when I am called Jap. Like many others, Suzuki felt the immediate future would be one of catastrophe. Almost everything was coming to crisis at once. Overpopulation and worldwide food shortages, pollution of the skies, the oceans, rivers, and lakes that sickened and killed natural life as well as increasing numbers of humans, energy shortages that, combined with the rest, might conceivably drive desperate nations into series of wars that culminate in a war more horrible than any the world had experienced. He also believed that natural disasters would increase and add millions to the casualty lists. But unlike other doom prophets, Suzuki believed that the disasters were only a prologue to a new age greater than any other. The human race would come to full fruit. The brain and the soul would finally be united. Already he saw glimmerings. The political uprisings throughout the world were not radical, he said. They were simple demands that humanity reverse its headlong rush to oblivion. Although he accused the industrial nations of overconsumption and waste, within his own country in the United States he saw examples of lifestyles based on conservation and sharing and the use of natural energy sources. These he called New Age. They were New Age ideas, New Age people. His eyes were fixed past the rubble of the past century. He said that everywhere he went, he looked for the New Age. And because he believed so strongly in the New Age, he did not fear the time of troubles just ahead. Suzuki's life was the mirror of his beliefs. It might be said that he walked his talk. His ministry was the road. I am hippie monk, he said. No home, no temple, no money. Just walking, sometimes hungry, sometimes cold, sometimes doubt, sometimes jail. Jesus say, don't keep food, money, clothes. Keep walking and believe in God. New Age people don't need heroes. We already have Jesus, Mary, and Buddha. The Jones family, Charles Manson, Sun Moon, and Billy Graham, all imitation. Before he went back on the road, he said that the United States was a mandala, that every ingredient for the future was within its borders. The people, the ideas, and the strength to endure and ultimately prevail over the hard times ahead. But he said that all the hateful isms that cripple humanity must be ruthlessly exorcised. Racism, sexism, these had to be eliminated if the human race is to pull together and create the new age. Until then, each moment is a miracle, he said. And sort of a postscript after the fall. Suzuki Katsumi hitchhiked through Oregon once before when he was going to Canada. A driver who picked him up outside Eugene was Vietnamese. He told Suzuki he had left Vietnam during the desperate evacuation of the defeated South in April 1975. He said his life had been one of struggle and hardship for the first 2 years in the United States. He had been out of work most of the time, and when he did find work, it was usually menial and low paying. He had been a student in Saigon before the fall. He applied to colleges throughout the U.S. and finally had been accepted by an Oregon college. Suzuki asked his field of study. Nuclear engineering, the Vietnamese answered. And that was The Road to Mandala. And I wrote that actually 11 years after I wrote The Peace Cardinal in 1979, the year I started up my newspaper, the New Times Eagle, the born again bird on the 3-year ashes of the old North Coast Times Eagle. Well, sort of as an epilogue to this program, this is the Thanksmas season. Christmas for me is the winter solstice when old King Saul begins to warp up to this top of the world. And the new year is the vernal equinox when life returns to this northern half of Gaia. So whatever season you celebrate, happy, 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 happy. And I shall be gone the next couple of weeks, visiting my sister over these holidays. And I guess before I say goodbye, I'd like to read a poem by a 12-year-old girl, Sarah Sherman. Christmas. Red and white stripes, pines that are green, bright wrap packages tied tight with string. Wreaths hang on doors, adorned with small snowflakes. Cookies and pies are what my mom bakes. Snowmen stand still, stuck in snowdrifts. People exchange many nice gifts. Christmas lights twinkle, little bells ring, and on top of the tree, my angel will sing. And that's from an anthology of poetry by Young Americans, 1998 edition. So she's a little older than 12 now. And this is Michael McCusker. Might as well wish you a Merry Christmas and a Happy New Year, because I won't see you until the new year.